Case number 21-3518, USA versus Adam Carson. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Chad for the appellant.
Counsel, sorry, we had some technical difficulties, but we're here with you now. So we're ready to go. And Mr. Chad, just let us know how much time you want for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, I'm here this afternoon representing Adam Carson, and I believe I've reserved 4 minutes for a rebuttal, if I may.
That's great. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. The district court in this case took Adam Carson's money without due process, without providing him any process whatsoever. In addition to that, the district court entered an order taking the money, but that order doesn't have sufficient findings in it, either for the statute or to allow this court to have any kind of meaningful appellate review of the district court's decision in this case. And finally, to the extent that the district court does have findings in that order, the record isn't sufficient to allow this court to even uphold the district court's decision on either of the necessary prongs that are required for the taking of the money in this case. That is that the money is a quote unquote substantial resource, one-time substantial resource, or that the money is non-exempt. For all of these reasons, we're asking the district court's order to be reversed and the money to be given back to appellant Carson.
So counsel, if we agree with your second point that we should remand for further findings, maybe to second, third points, can we leave your first point aside?
I think you can, Your Honor, as long as you further provide that Mr. Carson be given his day in court as to those topics. So in other words, I don't think you have to necessarily rule on the due process finding as long as Mr. Carson gets the opportunity to have his day in court as to whether or not it's a substantial resource and whether or not it's exempt or non-exempt funds.
And I assume you by that you mean the court could do it via pleadings and otherwise, unless it determines it needs a hearing.
I believe that to be the case, Your Honor. I don't think that a physical hearing is necessarily necessary, depending on how the evidence shakes out and whether there's a disagreement as to the evidence. But more than likely, it's probably going to be a matter of pleadings and exhibits.
What does substantial resources mean? Is it a relative term? How's a district court to figure it out?
So, Your Honor, the statute doesn't obviously define what a substantial resource is. Other circuits have defined it as along the lines of a windfall or a one-time unusual payment or an unusual influx of income that's not in the necessary form of like regular income that you would get from working. I do believe that it's probably up to the district court in the first instance to not only kind of define what substantial resource is, but then define that it actually does apply in this case.
You mentioned one-time payment. Does it have to be a one-time payment? What if the family gave him $300 every week?
So I think there is that is a problem, right? Since we don't know what substantial resources is, I think that it would be unfair to say that it can only be a one-time substantial payment of, let's say, X thousand dollars, right? But as to whether or not the family gives him $300 a week and then he uses that for living expenses and eating and whatnot, as to whether or not that's a substantial resource under the terms of 3664N, I do believe that's up to the district court to decide in the context of the particular case. Because I think the not correct thing to do would be to try to label it something very specific. In other words, you know, a one-time payment of over $2,500 is a substantial resource, because that might be true for one inmate, but it might not be true for another inmate.
Would it be a discretionary call by the district court?
I think it would be, if it goes back up to appeal, it would certainly be reviewed for abuse of discretion, I think. Yes. But none of that was actually decided in this case. If you take a look at the court's order that orders the money, it doesn't even talk about that it is a substantial resource or that it's non-exempt funds. It just says there's money in the inmate account. Take all of it except for $300. And that clearly doesn't make it under the statute, under any of the statutes.
Well, do you have any argument that this is not a substantial amount? It's $4,000 is like maybe over 75% of the restitution award.
So the reason that I don't have a good answer for that question is twofold. One, obviously, Mr. Carson never got his day in court. And so we don't know from his side where that what that $4,000 represents. We also don't know when the government
that doesn't go to substantial. That goes to whether it's work related money or something else.
It does, but the government never indicated where those funds came from as well. They just found that there was $4,000 sitting in his account.
I know. My question was just about the substantial.
Yeah.
Component.
So
I don't know how there's. I don't. What's the best argument? This is not.
Well, and I think the Hughes case out of the Fifth Circuit and Poff out of the Ninth both talk about a defendant can work in Unicor. He can accumulate money over time that might turn out to be thousands of dollars, but that doesn't mean that that's a substantial resource, right? Because the reason they give for that is that because it accumulates slowly over time and not big chunks. And
so, Poff, though, you agree, it found that a cash deposit of $2,600 and change was enough.
I disagree with that. So in Poff, they actually didn't find that. What they found was that he had $2,664 in his account. They actually remanded that case to try to determine how much of that was a deposit and how much of that was income that he received.
No, I agree with that, but I thought they said something to the effect of it would be substantial
if it was a one-time payment, but they didn't determine it actually was a one-time payment in that case.
So Judge Radler's question is a good one, right? Which is, it sounds, at least in your point, is you've got to remand it. You can't determine on this record. His point is, under what scenario would $4,000 not be substantial? And you concede if it's a one-time deposit or some large chunk of it is, that would be substantial.
Yes. And then you would go on to the second part of that. Is this exempt funds or not? Once you determine that it is substantial. Yes. And like I said, I think that substantial resources, again, is going to be different for every defendant because of the particularities. But, you know, a one-time chunk of $4,000 is probably going to be in the ballpark to get the government over the first hurdle to get to the second.
But are you saying it does not have to be a one-time sum of money, or are you saying it depends on the circumstances?
It depends on the circumstances. Like the, I believe it's the Eighth Circuit held in the Kidd case that you're usually looking at a one-time unusual payment, but it doesn't have to be just one time if it's still an unusual influx of money at one time. But, you know, to Judge Thapar's scenario, if the family gave 300 every X number of weeks and then accumulated over the time, I think you got a pretty good argument that that might not be a substantial resource along the lines of the windfall, the judgment, the, you know, the things that are kind of listed as examples in the statute. Although I will admit that the statute, even though it lists those as examples, those aren't the only things that it can do.
So how do you, if you have an account that includes earnings and deposits by family, how do you know which money, the money's fungible? How do you know whether what's there is from earnings or from the family?
Right, and so I think that's why a record at the district court level with findings would flesh all that out, because you could, you know, the way that the BOP system works, and I'm again working a little bit, it's outside of the record here, but kind of the way the BOP system works is when a defendant gets money into his system, there's a recording of kind of how that money got into the system. And certainly there can be proof on, okay, well, this came from a lottery winning, or this came from the family, this came from Unicor. There's all that's going to be within the system that a district court's going to parse through and say, okay, this money is a substantial resource, it's a windfall. This money is not, it's either weekly allowance from family or it's the Unicor money, and therefore I can make the finding based upon those findings. Again, none of that done in this case. There was just an allegation, hey, there's $4,000 in an account, let's take it.
And so your point really is they can get the bank statement or whatever it is that I've looked at before as well, obviously not in this record. The district court could have done that pretty easily. If it saw something that was unclear on it, it could have found out what that was through evidentiary means, and it didn't do any of that.
Didn't do any of that. And the defendant should have the right to at least explain where the money came from if there is a question, if it's in question as to whether it is in one of these two piles, right?
But I remember those statements pretty clearly, at least with regards to Unicor, said that's where they came from. With regards to outside payments, it's a little more difficult. I agree with that.
Absolutely. But it is doable, and it should have been done in this case. I see that I'm out of time. Unless the court has any other questions, leave the balance for rebuttal.
Can you just clarify one thing in the record for me? I appreciate your point about knowing the source of the funds. Didn't your client at least indicate to some extent that these were monies that were contributed by family? I mean, isn't that why we're talking about this?
Well, so in at the Court of Appeals level, right, when he was proceeding pro se, he put stuff in his brief and he attached some documents to his brief to make those arguments. None of that's in the district court record. There's nothing in the record as it exists before this court as a court of review to get us anywhere near there.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You'll have your full time for a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Ina, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Rima Ina, and I'm an assistant United States attorney representing the United States in this case. This court should affirm the district court's decision ordering the turnover of over $4,000 in Mr. Carson's inmate trust account to pay the restitution he owes for his crimes. As is said.
So here's why I have trouble with that. And let me just be candid with you. It seems to me that we don't know what that $4,000 comprised of. And as I understand it, maybe I'm wrong about this, I thought the district court ordered $3,700 turned over and $300 left in the account. But how does the district court know that that $300 isn't, like, that there isn't $400 of prison wages there? And how does the district court know how that $4,000 was accumulated? Because as Mr. Shad correctly said, the district court did nothing here. The government submitted something. They just basically rubber stamped it and passed it on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, if I may, originally Mr. Carson was put on a $32 a month payment plan because that's all he could afford towards his restitution. The government received notification that he now had over $4,000 in his account. They wrote the motion to the court, which is part of the record.
I'm sorry, the $32 a month, I thought it was 25% of prison wages. Am I thinking about that wrong?
That was the minimum that he had to pay. The actual payment plan that he was put on turned out to be $32 a month.
Is that based on his prison wages?
Yes. So when the United States received notification that he now had over $4,000 in his inmate trust account, this is after the payment plan was vetted and determined and agreed to, this represented a material change in his economic circumstances. And that is what set the wheels in motion for the turnover of his funds.
What provision, I'm sorry to interrupt you, in the statute allows you to seize or to take that money?
In 18 USC 366K, says that a restitution order shall provide that if the defendant or the United States or the victim notifies the court of a material change in the defendant's economic circumstances, the court may, on its own motion, or the motion of any party, adjust the payment schedule or require immediate payment in full as justice requires. That statute does not require a hearing or a fact-finding analysis. Since the statute has been determined to be self-executing by many circuits around the country, this is usually an automatic payment requirement. The United States of America gets notification of changes in the inmate trust accounts thousands at a time. And if it were to stop and to have a fact-finding analysis for every single time that changes occurred in an inmate's trust account, the system would come to a screeching halt.
So and what does it mean to be an adjustment?
Well, it says here an adjustment to the payment schedule or require immediate payment in full.
And so what you're saying is they were requiring immediate payment in full. But don't they have to give under 3664K the defendant an opportunity at least to explain why it's not?
The statute does not provide for that. It does not provide for that type of hearing. It says the court may on its own motion adjust the payment schedule. Again, this statute also is similar to 3664N, which was being spoken about previously regarding the substantial resources. I've cited cases in my brief on pages 12 and 13. Many courts have defined substantial resources pursuant to dollar amounts. As low as $1,400 or $1,000 have been determined to be substantial resources. And here we have over $4,000. Pursuant to the government's motion, this $4,000 was deposited at one time. So we do not have a situation here where we have accumulation of wages, prison wages, which the cases cited by opposing counsel can be distinguished in that way. The Woodridge and Hughes cases were gradual accumulation of prison wages, and that's not the situation.
Doesn't the defendant get the chance to challenge the government's assertion?
Again, the statute doesn't provide for that. Again, many circuits have determined this is an automatic payment that is triggered by the change in the financial circumstances of the inmate. Under the Crime Victims' Rights Act, the defendant...
The statute requires some determination of where the money came from. At least to segregate out certain amounts.
There are some exemptions because the United States may treat the restitution order as a lien. And under that statute, there are some exceptions, and those would be things that would be like tax exempt, such as wearing apparel, fuel, books, unemployment benefits. None of these exceptions apply in this case because this is a lump sum of cash. And
District Court make that finding? I know you provided notice of it. Did the district court make any findings?
The motion to the court said that. The court's order says the full amount of non-exempt funds must be turned over. So it left room for if any of these funds is determined to be exempt, they would.
But then so now is the onus on the defendant to come forward? I mean, is there some sort of process? Because Mr. Shad also says, look, if you can take his property without any process, that's a due process violation. So to the extent this provision K provides for that, it creates constitutional problems if you don't give the defendant an opportunity to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, under 3613A, the United States can step into the defendant's shoes and take the money because it is owed like a lien. And that's why they do not have to provide him a hearing or any kind of due process because it is owed as like a lien would be owed. And again, these exemptions are very rare to apply to someone in prison. Again, it would be, like I said before, unemployment benefits, books, fuel, wearing apparel, workers' comp. These are things that inmates don't receive in prison. So the exceptions wouldn't apply here. And that's why it would be futile or in vain to stop and do a hearing every single time.
Is there any mechanism? Suppose the government makes a mistake of some kind, and the district court the next day issues an order following what the government's done. Does the defendant get any chance at all to challenge the order?
Now, the inmate, I'm sure, received notification of what happened, and that's what brought this legal action to court. He could have filed a grievance. If an exemption does apply, he certainly could have brought it up in a grievance. And also, in this case...
Didn't this happen, like, quite quickly in time? Did the government one day and the court very quickly then enter the order?
They did.
Okay, who's the defendant supposed to file the grievance with, and when?
He can file it with the prison, who at the time was still in possession of the funds before they turned it over.
When? I mean, the court's already issued an order dispersing the funds to the government.
Well, in that time.
What time? The 24 hours?
I mean, theoretically.
Not the prisoner in 24 hours is supposed to do this. That can't be the answer.
You know, interestingly enough, if that is opposing, if that is the appellant's argument, that an exception.
My argument. It's not their argument. It's my argument. It's my question.
Okay. I mean, in the scenario, I don't know when he would have been able to do that. Again, in the scenario, an exception doesn't apply.
I guess we don't necessarily know that for certain. And there's some, we might want some certainty that these are donated funds as opposed to worker, money he's accumulated through work. And this scheme you've put forward, not scheme in terms of correct way, but the process you put forward gives the defendant no say before the order is issued. Then the appeal clock starts running. I'm just not sure. It doesn't seem to accommodate at all an objection by the defendant. Maybe you think that's the process doesn't require that and the statutes don't require that. It just, as a practical matter, doesn't seem to me to afford the defendant any opportunity to weigh in, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the statutes do say what they say, and they do not provide for any type of hearing.
What did you provide to the court? Remind me, did you provide the financial statement to show it was a one-time payment by the family?
Just as an initial matter, this wasn't a one-time payment by the family. I understand that that is on the record. What this actually was a stimulus check. The $4,000 was a stimulus check.
Counsel, I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Yes.
What did you provide to the court?
The United States did file a motion with the court. They did not provide bank statements. They did not. The $4,000 was a stimulus check.
$4,000 was what?
A stimulus check, the coronavirus stimulus checks. Many prisoners did receive stimulus checks. And so the United States filed these motions and got most of the stimulus money back. And then Mr. Carson chose to, as a
why are right, prisoners getting stimulus checks?
Under the Coronavirus Act, everything just went out very quickly. Once the United States realized that the inmates received the money, that's why they filed all of these for turnover to get it back. That was why they moved to turn over the money to get it back. And
was indicated that district court this was a stimulus check?
Unfortunately, that is not in the record.
Right, so by this regime you set up, district court enters the order, we appeal, we appoint counsel, we get all these briefing, and then you tell us today that it's a stimulus check and we're supposed to accept that and say, okay, no problem, and then affirm. That just can't, and really it's incumbent upon the government to come forward with that information.
Yes, Your Honor. And the fact that it's a stimulus check isn't the deciding factor here. Even if it was a lump sum payment from his family, the same rationale.
My problem, counsel, it sounds like we're setting up because, okay, let's assume it's a stimulus check. But what you're doing is you're setting up a process. You're asking us to set up a process that anytime the government comes forward, the defendant has no say and the money can be taken out. And if, as to Judge Radler's question, if the government makes a mistake, there's no way to stop it. You say go to prison and file a grievance. Is the prison, tell me a prison in America that's going to defy a district court order and say, okay, we're not going to send that money out because you filed a grievance. There's no way to stop it. So imagine it is prison wages and you have a garnishment order and the guy's making $90 a month and he's in for 240 months. And I get that this was only 4 years, but if he's making $100 a month or whatever it is, $96, in addition to the 32, I could see a world where he accumulates $600 and then the government comes forward when he gets a windfall, so you're entitled to the money, and the district court does no inquiry and just gives $3,700 up. They're taking away some of the wages that they're not entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, in that scenario, when an inmate is making wages, that circumstance is taken into account when the inmate has the repayment plan and they're set up on a repayment plan. And that's what was done here for Mr. Carson. What happened was an extreme change in his financial circumstances with the $4,000. And it wasn't from him accumulating.
Am I wrong? I thought you said they were taking $32 a month pursuant to the garnishment order, the original restitution order, which, as I understand, is 25%, which means he's making $128 or whatever a month. So he is making about $100 a month that he gets to keep. And so that's my only point is, imagine a case where he doesn't get a $4,000 stimulus check, but there is some portion of money put in. What if the government mistakenly takes it all?
What's his recourse? That would be a different scenario because that wouldn't represent a material change, which would trigger the statute.
Has $1,000 that he's put in wages, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and $3,000 that is deposited, that sounds like a material change to me.
Well, the $3,000 deposited is.
Right. So then what happens when the government comes forward and claims $4,000? You're saying the district court could rubber stamp that without the defendant being able to say, wait a minute, $1,000 has nothing to do with that because those are wages I had in the account. And so back to Judge Radler's initial question, what if the government makes a mistake?
Mm-hmm. In this scenario, the government was notified of the $4,000 lump sum deposit, which was a change. And that's what had triggered the statute. Which required the turnover.
I mean, it would have been nice if we could look at the record and the government would have said, look, this is a stimulus check. We mistakenly paid these prisoners. And so we want to use this provision to make restitution. Mm-hmm. It seems to me the court then could have said, okay, I can see the $4,000 stimulus check. So I'm at least making that finding. Here, there's no findings, mm-hmm. right? There's not even a finding of a material change by the district court, in essence. Is there?
The district court did not say that in its order. It didn't. The other circuits have determined that the statute is self-executing and that findings of fact and spelling that out in the order isn't always required per other circuits. Again, under the statutes that we have in front of us, that kind of fact-finding isn't a requirement under the statute. Again, the United States does thousands of these at a time. And so the sheer volume that they have, I guess that would be the only rationale I can give you as to why it's not more thorough and detailed.
Let me ask one more question. You don't do thousands of these at a time unless you screw up, right? I mean, this is the United States saying we screwed up. We sent all these monies to inmates. And so now we're doing thousands of them at a time. Because in my 10 years on the district court, I don't remember a single one of these.
I know in this scenario, we had thousands at a time because of what happened. Yes.
Can I ask one other question? Separate issue.
Yes.
Did the government notify the defendant about these change? Or sorry, the victim. Did the government notify the victim about these change in circumstances?
The government is to notify the victim. The attorney general is to notify the victim.
Yes, I agree. Did that happen?
I don't know that.
But don't you have to certify it to the court in order for this provision to be self-executing?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, it is, and I can review the record to ensure that was done. But yes, I assume that was done. I can review the record to ensure.
Wouldn't that be something you normally would tell the district court rather than assuring the court of appeals that you'll go back and look at the record later on?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is required under the statute, which is what the government moved under the statute for the turnover.
My audio isn't great. Are you saying that the prisoner was notified that the government was notifying the judge that there had been a substantial change with an eye toward changing the restitution? that he received that notice before you went before the court?
We did send him notice. The court sent the order the next day after the motion. So the court ordered the turnover before, presumably before the inmate received our notice.
I'm sorry, you're saying that after the court ruled, it was sent to the prisoner?
It was sent the day before, but he may not have received it before the order issued.
Okay.
Any other questions, Judge White?
No, thank you.
Judge Radler?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chad?
Yes, Chad,
you have just 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of cleanup comments, and I don't know if I'll take all 4 minutes. Judge White, to your question, I just want to make sure that the record's clear. They filed the motion on, let's say, day one, and then they sent a copy of that motion via U.S. mail to the defendant, who is in prison, in a federal prison. The next day, the court signed off on the order. So, you know, for all practical purposes, there's no way that the defendant received the motion before the order was signed. But more than that, he didn't have certainly didn't have the opportunity to respond to that motion the order was filed.
Set aside the due process concerns for a second,
because
I understand your argument there. Do you agree? It looks to me like your friend's argument on the other side, Messina's, is a valid one in the sense, I'm not saying the United States complied, that it is self-executing. It reads as if it's self-executing if they certify, if they do all the things they're supposed to do.
So I'll disagree with that on two levels. So the first level is that today they are relying on 3664K. They never relied upon that at the district court level. If you take a look at their motion, they never rely on K. They only go with N.
And no, I understand. Look, but I think you have a good argument. What I'm asking is more of a hypothetical, is if they complied, is it self-executing? That's what I want to understand.
No. And the reason it's not self-executing is in one of the cases that they cited to you, and that's United States versus Syed. It's a Seventh Circuit case. And that is the case that they rely on about the standing in the shoes of the defendant because it's a lien, and that K's language makes it self-executing. But Syed actually says, except for non-exempt property. And so,
she admitted that.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
She admitted that non-exempt would not be covered.
Right. But the problem here is that you can't use the term self-executing when a district court has to make a finding that it's exempt or non-exempt property. In other words, something has to happen. If it was self-executing, then a couple things. One, you wouldn't have to motion the court. And number two, you wouldn't have to go through and have someone make a determination of whether it's exempt or non-exempt property. That is the
opposite of self-executing. They only have to notify the court. So assume they notify the court and say, look, we screwed up. We sent them 4,000. We certified to the victim that there's this windfall. And then that's all we're telling you is we're giving you a notification. It says the district court may on its own motion do this.
Yes, and the court may on its own motion do that. None of that obviously occurred, but I think more than that, the court has to satisfy itself that it's still non-exempt. And that has to be at least within the motion or something, right? And so there's got to be another side to that for that to even occur. And there's got to be a process for the defendant to at least say, no, this is exempt property and here's why. And by the way, that list of exempt properties, a lot more than just books and things like that. There's like, I think four of the things are money. You know, it's like child support payments, it's disability payments, it's tax, maybe tax returns. I can't remember the
I
list.
Think there's
a lot of money. There's a lot of money in there. And again, so that's kind of where Mr. Carson sits today. And he is due his day in court on this, at least have the opportunity to explain. He should get his money back until they can prove that it shouldn't be his.
Can I ask you, counsel, the point I asked your friend on the other side about notification of the victim? I don't think you argue on appeal that we should vacate and remand in part because the victims were not notified.
Well, so I actually, I think I put it in my reply brief because that section in K, so I do this whole argument that says.
Oh, let me just, I'll go back and look at your reply brief. I didn't see it in your
opinion. Yeah.
But is it your, that's on remand, is it your position that that has to happen before a district court can enter the order?
If they want to rely on K, which up till appeal, they have not.
And what's your best, it says it has to happen. The statute says should happen. The statute, to my reading, doesn't say it's a prerequisite to the court entering.
I think it's shall in the statute.
Shall notify, the court's duty is the court's works off of notification,
right?
But I would read notification maybe not about the notice to the victim, but by someone's notice to the court.
Yeah, so there's also, and I don't have the statute in front of me, but isn't it also shall certify that they have done the
So your argument that that's a prerequisite is just straight from the tech. That's
absolutely sentence. Absolutely.
Anything else, Judge Radler?
No.
Judge White. How did this ever go back before the court?
The district court?
Yeah.
No. So what happened was the notice of appeal or the motion was filed. The order was ordered the next day. And then Mr. Carson filed a notice of appeal thereafter. So there's been nothing else in the district court on this topic. Okay. It's a very, very finite record.
Okay.
Anything else, Judge White?
No, thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. Thank you for doing this, and we really appreciate it. Thank you for doing it via Zoom. We appreciate your thoughtful arguments, and we'll take it under consideration.
Thank you.